Well, good morning, everyone. Perhaps 2 days after summer solstice and in Southern California, to be talking of about snow avalanches is going to seem rather strange, but that's what I want to report on in the next 25 minutes or so. And this work is done jointly with two colleagues, Kristin Martha Hagnardottir and Thomas Johannesson. They're both Icelanders, and the relevance of that will become clear now. So the story begins today in northwest Iceland, a place called Flateyri, which is up in the top corner. And here's a photo of Flateyri. You see it's a village which is extended over this kind of spit. The old part of the village is here, but in recent times there was lots of new housing built in this region. And this village was at risk from snow avalanches, and so they built a series of defence structures, and that's what you can just about see in this photo. I'm afraid it hasn't come out terribly clearly. But it's a series of conical mounds, and the purpose of these conical mounds was to stop the snow avalanche. If it was coming down this way, this was going to slow the flow sufficiently to protect all the houses behind it. Those ones are the original ones, and I don't know, because they're now knocked down. There is a handbook which tells you how big to build these things, and they recommend heights of about 5 meters or so. The part of this task is going to be re-examining the handbook. I'm writing the new handbook, if you like. Okay. Well, now, on the 26th of October in 95, a large avalanche struck this village, and the mounds didn't work. So here's some photos of the damage. This is in the center of the village, and you can see, that's a church spire. So it's a very large volume of snow came down and just wiped out a series of houses. Here's a view of some of the damage that was caused. Ah, this is actually an avalanche rescue dog digging a hole looking for people. There were fatalities in this accident, 20, which was one of the most serious accidents that had been experienced in Iceland. Well, now, the thing that worried the Icelanders in particular was that they had avalanche models, and they assessed what they thought were the dangerous zones. And virtually all the houses that were destroyed were within safe zones. Well, of course, perhaps to this crowd, we shouldn't be surprised that the models didn't work very well. I mean, I guess at a fundamental level, there's things we don't know about avalanche flows, and this is unfortunately a rather tragic consequence of that. So what happened? Following this rather large incident, they decided to do some more research into avalanche dynamics and to work out if there was better strategies. And one thing they did was just to look back through history. And so this is a plot, this is longitude and latitude, and each dot marks a place where there's been a significant avalanche occurring in Iceland, which has led to either economic damage or loss of life. Well, the point being that this is actually picking out the whole of the coastline of Iceland. Yes, that's right. It's partly a function of the topography of Iceland, which is essentially you have the coastal region and it rises very strongly to a flat plateau. So people only live around the edges. But the point is, I'm trying to make here, is that the whole of the coastline is at risk from avalanches coming out of these mountain gullies. So that's just superimposing the coastline. And the two places I want to talk about, there's Flateyri in the northwest, and then 20 years before, there'd been a rather large incident in the east of the country. So their review suggested that they needed to do various things to improve their avalanche defense. And as they wanted to relocate villages, establish evacuation procedures, somehow stabilize the snowpack. I'm not going to say anything about those. In fact, I think probably academics would be rather bad at organizing any of those. What I want to tell you today is about deflecting dams and breaking mounds. And what I mean by this is a deflecting dam is one where the avalanche comes on and you just want to turn it somewhat away from the village. And these breaking mounds, that's like the conical structures that had been employed previously at Flateyri. So they're discrete structures of a certain height and width which are aimed to slow down the flow. Well, here's what they applied to do. This is in Icelandic, so no one can read it, I'm presuming, including me. And this is a blurb of some photos of the mock-up of what they wanted to do. This is in the east of the country. And here they wanted to build a series of mounds, offset, so in a kind of a checkerboard pattern, and then a big dam behind it. So the danger for here is a gully which comes down here, hits these mounds, slowed by them, and then can't get over the dam, and so the village is safe. Okay, and this is just looking back up. It's these gullies here which are delivering snow avalanche. The problem for this village is that you can't deflect the flow. You can't just turn it left or right because the village is strung out along the coastline. So if you want to make it safe, you have to stop it. I should have said at the beginning that snow avalanches, just to set the context, move at speeds of 30 to 50 meters a second or so. Okay, well, these things have now been built. And so I can now answer your question as to how big they are. So here you see two rows of mounds and a big dam at the back. So these mounds are 10 meters tall and 30 meters across. And the dam at the back is 20 meters tall and about 200 meters or so. So they're not small. Here's a thing for scale in the winter. And you can see for scale, here's a car. And so this is a 10 meters high. Well, if I understand the question correctly, you're asking about the nature of the avalanche, whether they're powder snow avalanches or dense avalanches. So here there's a difference between what Icelandic people think their avalanches are like and what Alpine people think. So they see the major threat in Iceland as very dense avalanches with very little powder snow around. Okay. So what we did was a series of experiments and mathematical analyses to try and understand these dynamics. And so I'm going to report on some experiments we did. And so here's a setup, a typical lab setup. We've done it at several different scales, but we might have a chute, which we inclined at 37 degrees or something like that, and then a runout zone. And we put obstacles down at the bottom of the chute, and we see how the flow interacts with those obstacles. The particles we use, we've used several, but the ones we mainly use are glass ballatini, which are 100 micron. We also use sand and PVC and mustard seeds and various things. Essentially, the results are fairly robust as to what material we use. So typical... the width. Again, various setups, 50 centimeters would be typical. But we've done various scales. I'll show you photos of some other scales as well. So release a certain amount of at the top, let it flow down, and then take observations of the interaction with the obstacles, and then measure how far it goes. And we use video and depth particles and tracers, whatever we can do. Just to make a distinction, I'm going to be talking about dams and mounds. When I say dams, they block the entire width of the chute. When I say mounds, they're discrete, and so the particles can potentially squeeze in between the gaps. And in fact, when they first started working with us, that's what they were interested in, because they were going to build these mounds in the east of Iceland. I know this slide hasn't come out, so I'll move on. But I'll tell you what I was going to say there, that the Froude number we measured of the flow, Froude number u squared over gh cosine of the inclination, in our experiments was always about 10 to 12. So a very high Froude number, strongly inertial, if you like. And that's because we were trying to match the natural regime in which they think the flows are a Froude number of order 10 to 15. So the first thing we found was that when the flow hit the obstacle, whether this be a dam or a mound, you get a very coherent jet which is launched off the top. Okay. Well, let me show you some photos of this. So this is a rather larger scale experiment. This is done in a garage in Switzerland, where we released 50 kilos of particles at once. And this dam here is 5 centimeters tall. Okay, the flow comes down and hits, and you get a jet formation which kind of jumps off the top. And we're going to be interested in the form of that coherent jet. And now I can show you a movie. So this now is in a lab scale, so this is back to being 3 meters and perhaps 10 kilos of particles. I've rotated the camera. So horizontal is now like this. Okay? So, you should think of this being horizontal, and I've rotated the camera to get a better view. And you're seeing the flow comes down, hits this dam, which is inclined at 45 degrees to the chute and forms this fairly coherent jet. And what we're in the business of is trying to understand something about that jet. It ranged. Yes, it ranged. So our height of the obstacle ranged from a factor of 1 to 7. So sometimes they were the same height as the flowing layer, sometimes they were up to 7 times as large. In the design they opted for, they went for about 4 times. That's actually going to be an important feature. Yeah. Not directly. We can measure flow speeds before and afterwards, but we didn't put any measurement device in the barrier itself. Okay, so this is just a still, again, from the lab, and now the camera isn't rotated. And the point I'm trying to show here is the coherence of this jet. So this is just dry glass particles hitting the dam and jumping. Okay, so if you saw... Yes? Okay, so that's something, again, we varied. In the little movie there I was showing you, it was at 45 degrees, but we varied it. In fact, I'm going to say something a little bit about that. Okay. So it never pointed back. It was never greater than 90. You get particle infill if that happens. Particle infill, so the particles come down and just fill in the space. Okay, so you might have guessed that the jet trajectory, well, it looks fairly parabolic in shape, and essentially that's what it is. It's ballistic. Once it takes off, it's just governed by gravity. We can check that by measuring the shape of it, and by also checking that the horizontal flow speed is constant, and both of those hold very well. So then what we're interested in is how far does this jet jump? Especially if you're going to build two lines of obstacles, you don't want it to be jumping over the second row. Or else you've built all these things for nothing. So to do that, if we know the speed, what we really need to know is the angle at which it gets launched at. And that angle is not the same as the upstream face. It depends on the relative height of the depth of the flow to the depth of the obstacle. Okay, so I think this slide tries to convince you that these are, in fact, parabolas. So what we did, we took images of the jet and then fitted parabolae through them, and you see that really it is just ballistic profiles. So it's from the moment it gets launched through to when it lands again. So you're interested in the spread of the jet as it goes, so is centerline. So each of these ones is for different ratios of depth of flow to depth of obstacle. So what we want to do is to predict the jump length and the jump height, because it's got important implications for these avalanche defense measures. So what we need to know is the flow angle. What angle do you actually get launched at? Is that equal to, well, I've already said it's not equal to, the angle of the front of the dams? Well, now I was reminded then of a calculation you can make in inviscid irrotational fluid mechanics. So this might be in a first course in fluid mechanics you can take, where you learn about conformal mappings. Turns out that you can actually calculate this. So if you have a free surface flow coming on and hitting a solid barrier, you can then calculate the angle at which it gets launched in the absence of gravity, if you ignore gravity. And that's exactly the angle we want to know. So I've shown some details here about how you construct this conformal mapping, but I won't go into it anymore. It's in textbooks, and I can give you references if you like. Okay, so just to emphasize, this is for an incompressible, irrotational, and inviscid two-dimensional fluid flow. And the type of predictions... Well, that's very strange. Okay, the type of predictions it gives you is of the throw angle as a function of how tall the obstacle is to how deep the avalanche flow is. And here you can see that if the front face is 30 degrees, as the obstacle becomes taller, you asymptote towards 30 degrees, and similarly for 60 degrees and for 90 degrees and for any angle you want. So eventually, when the obstacle is tall enough, you do actually get launched at the angle of the front face. But if the obstacle is not insufficiently tall, you don't get launched at that angle. Well, what I've superimposed in here is some of our data measurements for 60 degree and 30 degree front faces. Of course, what they want to do is to build 90 degrees. They want to build them so they have flat fronts. And so we did some experiments with 90 degrees. and this is the theoretical curve, and here's various data series we did at different scales, being lab scale, being 2 meters or 3 meters, being large scale in a garage, 10 meter scale. And also in here is some very old experiments which were done with fluid. So this is just having a flow of water coming down and hitting a dam and measuring what angle it takes off it. And that seems to lie in amongst the granular data. Okay. Well, scaling is a problem with granular experiments in that how can you be certain what you do actually applies to the very large scale? And that then prompted a new series of experiments. So because they were actually building these things, they actually wanted to do large-scale experiments involving snow. And that's quite interesting to see whether we get the same type of predictions. So this is a photo of an avalanche research center at the top of the Alps. So this is 2,500 meters up in Switzerland, in Davos. And we're going to be working on this chute. So here, we're on the train with the skiers. So what we have to do, we have to load up the container with snow. And we, in each experiment, perhaps we release a ton and a half of snow. Okay, so you put it behind some kind of gate. This gate is going to be what opens up and lets the flow be generated. Here is a rather brave photo, actually. The flow has been initiated, and this is looking back upstream at the oncoming flow. For scale, this is about 2.5 meters, and this stuff is moving at 6 or 7 meters per second. Okay. So what we did, we put obstacles in the way, and we measured the deflection you get. And this is a photo of just when the flow has hit an obstacle. And this obstacle height now is, this is about 1 meter. And we can film it from the side and measure the profile and measure the speeds and things. We can also, there's also profile sensors in the base of the chute and in the side, so we can get some sense of kind of boundary measurements. This photo also shows that you shouldn't build your obstacles out of wood. Because at the moment of impact, this has actually broken the wood. Okay. Well, of course, I wouldn't be telling you about this if it didn't concur with the lab experiments. And in fact, if we go back to that original plot, it lies exactly in amongst the lab experiments. So in some sense, these interactions are only governed by the mass flux and the inertia of the flow. In some sense, they're not feeling the actual constituents that they have, and they're not being affected by the local drag forces. Okay. So I should also say, well, so most of the experimental shots I've shown you are of dams, and that's this situation where we've dammed the whole way. Of course, we've also done some stuff with mounds where we have discrete obstacles. From those, you also get these coherent jets launched, and the behavior is very similar. However, there's also the possibility of the flow squeezing into the gaps. And initially, the design engineers thought that's how the project was going to work, that the flow would squeeze into the gaps, and somehow that would increase the dissipation. They were rather surprised to find the formation of jumps. Well, we did some systematic investigations, and if we blocked 60% of the flow width, which is the kind of design criteria they had in mind, and then used how far did it go, a runout length, once it's past the obstacle, relative to the runout length if there's no obstacle. So if there's no obstacle, this is one, and if you put an obstacle in, you dissipate energy, and so you don't go as far. The message for dams is the higher you build your dam, the less, once it's jumped and landed again, the less far it goes. But with mounds, things seem to, you never seem to get below this plateau. So the most we could reduce the runout was by 40% for mounds. And the interpretation of that is that what you're actually doing is generating some three-dimensional flow. And so initially you've got your flow, and not everything goes over the top, but some gets turned into each other. Okay. And you have we have some images of that three-dimensional flow pattern. But what I want to move on to is to tell you something now about deflecting dams. So this is the other strategy. Here it's in some sense easier because you don't want to actually arrest the flow; you can just turn it somewhat. Now this is the village flat array I mentioned at the start. Along this spit, and this outline here is what happened in 95. An avalanche started down this mountain gully and came out and wiped out this part of the village completely. So as a consequence of that, they decided to build two deflecting dams, which are these things shown in red here and here. And here there's actually been a large-scale experimental test, if you like. There have been subsequent avalanches, which are these ones here, in 99 and this one in 2000, where the deflecting dam has done what it should. It's actually managed to turn the flow away from the village. So in some sense, this has been tested at very large scale, unlike the other ones. So let's just show you a photo of these things. This is an aerial photo, and again, these are large structures. Here are the two dams, and the two gullies which deliver the avalanches are from here and here. Okay, so this is something else we could investigate experimentally. So what I'm going to do is show you a movie of, again, some chute flow experiments. I might show you a movie. We always have Icelandic folk music playing whilst experimenting. So you're looking at an oncoming flow of grains which hits a barrier. And our grains are also these glass ballottini particles. Here we've changed the configuration to have a sustained flow, so we can deliver a flow for 30 seconds or so. The flow in this case is about a centimetre thick and moves at various Froude numbers ranging from 5 up to about 12. Okay, so the flow is coming down in this direction, and here in this movie you're seeing a deflector which is at 10 degrees to the oncoming flow. Now what I want you to notice is the structure here. Okay, so this is a jump in height that occurs as you hit the obstacle. And those of you with a kind of fluid dynamics background will recognize this as a polar shock. Okay, so the shock is attached to this corner here, and we have this profile here. And across the shock, the flow depth changes, and here it significantly increases. Perhaps the flow depth increases by a factor of 5. And the flow direction changes from being down the slope to parallel with the deflector. Okay. So what we can do is mathematically model this using a shallow layer model of the dynamics. So how do we do this? Essentially, we assume that the pressure is hydrostatic. So it's just proportional to the density and the height of the layer and gravity. So that's what the pressure is. And then across the shock, which I've shown with this dashed red line, we have to conserve mass. So plus and minus means the mass flux either side of the shock. And then we also have to conserve momentum. So we have the normal momentum and the tangential momentum. This gives us two components. And what we want is to measure the deflection angle, the angle beta, and the new flow depth and new flow speed as a function of the upstream velocity and height and the angle of the deflector itself, gamma. So we want these three unknowns as a function of these three quantities. And a particular important quantity is going to be the upstream Froude number. Okay. Well, this is what the theory looks like. So this is a rather complex plot. Let me run through it. So what I'm plotting here is the shock angle, the deflection angle, beta, as a function of gamma, the angle of the deflector, and I've plotted it for various values of the Froude number. So each of these solid curves is for a different Froude number. And the Froude number, well, the curve right in the top corner, which I can't reach, that is the Froude number just greater than 1. And these ones are in the regime we're interested in, kind of Froude number of order 10 or so. So what do you notice? You notice that for each angle of the deflector, so if I had a deflector of 10 degrees, as in the movie, there's two possible shock angles. And also, that there is a maximum angle of deflector that's possible. So let me choose a Froude number in the case of the curve 2, which I think is Froude number about 8. And we find that if you have a deflector angle bigger than 40 degrees or so, you can't find an attached shock. Okay. So this is quite analogous to what you find in models of gas dynamics and the structure of the polar shocks. Things work out slightly differently because of the conservation across the shock. Anyway, what do we find? I'll come to that. So this is when there is an attached shock. And here's our data points, our different granular experiments. This is the measured against the theory. And so really, this is doing a pretty good job. Perfect agreement would be the solid line. Okay. And I should say in here that we also did some experiments just with water as well. I mean, the shallow water theory also worked with water, and indeed it does. Okay, Jim's question, very good question. So what happens if you're at a shock angle bigger, so there's no attached shock? What happens is that the shock moves upstream. So it's no longer attached to the corner point. Let me show that by going. So it's no longer attached to this corner point, but it's somewhere upstream, and it's no longer a straight line. And in fact, we find that in experiments as well. That if you have very wide deflector angles, the shock point kind of moves around a bit. Okay, well, I think that's about all I want to say with. So I'll just show you again an image of these things and how these have scarred the landscape of Iceland, but perhaps have protected some of the villages. So thank you very much. So, experts in snow mechanics talk about three types of flow. So they talk about the very dense layer, where I guess the interactions are collisional, perhaps, and that's the regime in which I guess a lot of the talks this week have been focused. They then talk about a saltation regime, where the density is perhaps lower by a factor of 10, and the things just undergo ballistic jumps. And they then talk about a powder snow regime, which again, where the density is again lower by perhaps a factor of 10, so we're down 1% or lower by volume. And the grains are essentially supported by fluid turbulence. So the interactions work in a different way. I think no one really knows. It tends not to be included, but that might be just because people don't know how to include it.
You mentioned that in fact at the end of the day, what really matters is just the mass and inertia. And therefore, you can ask the question of how you should actually shape these and what height you should see them, if you have multiple layers. Mm-hmm. And you actually think about optimizing, for example,
yes, and in fact, part of the parametric study we did with the experiments, at any rate, was to change the slope of the upstream front of the obstacle and their geometry. They had design reasons why they wanted to build these kind of trapezoidal shapes, so kind of wider at the bottom and then narrower at the top. And we couldn't shift them from that. But you're right. Yes, the layout does tend to change things. In fact, what we found was the best strategy was to have lots of rather small obstacles, and essentially that works well because when you have lots of small ones, the flow is then turned into each other, and it's that actually turning the flow onto each other is rather good at losing momentum. So that's well, we got them to change a little bit. The main thing that they were worried about was the spacing between the rows, and being worried about how far the jet would jump. And so they did actually change the spacing to so that they wouldn't jump the second row.
Maybe a related question is about the jet, you know, talking about the annual jet, spreading, which again comes out of the mechanics.
Yes, that's right. No, we didn't look at that, but you could do, yes.
To what extent do you think your result might be applicable to mudslides?
I would have thought, yeah, if you want to build defences against mudslides, really all the ingredients in the calculations here you just need to know what the mass flux is and what the momentum flux is, and the nature of the constituent doesn't play a huge role. It plays a slight role when we're making these calculations of shock angles, because we've assumed that the pressure is hydrostatic, or equivalently that the stress tensor is isotropic. But yes, to leading order, yeah. I mean, the same idea should work for mud flows, yeah. right. Yes. Well, I think normally the flows are so rapid that the scale over which friction plays a role is much longer than the scale of the interaction. True, true. If you had a rather less inertial flow than this one, yes.
In your calculations of the meld, you use potential flow theory, and then later in the dam, you looked at supercritical theory and shocks. Why not also have the appearance of shocks in the around the mounds?
That's a nice question. Allows me to say something else as well. So, in fact, in our experiments, when we were doing our dams, we never went to design heights more than 7 times the flow depth. Well, of course, if you went to a very high dam, nothing would get over. You'd get a reflected ball moving back upstream, similarly to how you do in fluid mechanics. And in fact, what we find is both experimentally and with some theory that we have, that when you get to a relative depth of flow to height of obstacle of around 8 or so, you begin to get the presence of a ball that moves upstream, as well as having some material jumping over the top. Yeah. Yeah, I guess. I suppose they want to build it and they want it to stay there. So That's right. Yes. So I mean, they don't want it to be moved away by an impact or. So from that sense, they do want rigid obstacles. But I take the point that if you had some kind of cushioning, you could absorb some of the impact. Yeah, I don't know what you'd build it of, but you're thinking. No. They're good at rocks, yes.
What would enforce your potential theory approach concerning weight snow avalanches is that this kind of avalanches occurs between different layers of snow lacking of causality. And so really we can approximate the flowing layer as a plug flow. Yeah, and the substrate is lubricated.
So you're talking about the kind of whole slab of snow failing and becoming mobile. Yes, exactly. I think that's right.